Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I thank you for joining me for the Heretics Hour on this Monday, September 22nd, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. Today has been the 100th year anniversary of a highly celebrated event from World War I, celebrated by the Germans, that is, and something of a tragedy for the British. A single submarine commanded by one Lieutenant Otto Weddigen sank three British warships in the space of about 1 hour. But it served them right because they were part of the naval blockade that Britain had imposed immediately after the start of the war, which was less than 2 months before this time. They were in the Channel, these British ships, and bad weather had forced the accompanying destroyers to turn off as they could not keep up with the great battleships in the heavy seas as they patrolled back and forth in a straight line, keeping 1.5 miles distant from one another. And then the flagship of the group, the HMS Euralis, also turned off because the coal supply was running low. All that remained were the Aboukir, I'm not sure I pronounced that right, but Aboukir, the Cressy, and the Hogue, now commanded by Captain John Drummond as the longest-serving ship commander of the three. So he was kind of in command of all three, although he had been in one of the ships. Then on the evening of September 21st, which would have been yesterday evening, 100 years ago, 1914, the weather cleared and Drummond had not called back his destroyer, though, which was turned out to be a fatal mistake. I guess they were feeling pretty safe and pretty confident there. But at 6:25 in the morning, the first torpedo hit the HMS Aboukir port side and damaged it severely. Immediately, the other two cruisers set sail toward the sinking sister ships, and their commanders believed that Drummond's ship had hit a mine. This was one that Drummond was in. I didn't say that... it goes without speaking that that this Otto Weddigen had seen these ships, and he maneuvered himself to be able to get a good shot at the first one, and he did hit it and cause it to start sinking, and he then maneuvered to reach this in his U-boat to reach the second cruiser also on its port side. And two torpedoes took down the ship in 10 minutes. He made two hits with that one. And so the Cressy was left, and its captain, Wilmot Nicholson, was sailing for the two sister ships. At 7:20 a.m., the U-9, the sub, fired two torpedoes, one of which went wrong. The other one caused only slight damage. Now Weddigen had exactly one weapon left. And he turned his boat and shot it from the aft torpedo tube, which is, I guess, where it was. But he managed a direct hit with that. And that ship went down too, and a total of 1,459 British sailors drowned. Only 837 were rescued. Now, this sounds harsh, but remember, those ships were intended to starve, and they intended to starve millions of Germans into submission and defeat. Therefore, Weddigen became a hero in Germany, and the crew of the U-9 were showered with gifts. Children recorded the success of sinking the three ironclads. Postcards with photo montages of the battle became bestsellers. You can read this on my website at carolynyeager.net, where I posted it last night, is a little bit more to it. But I need to finish the story by saying that, I'll do it this way. It was seen as a David and Goliath scenario that this little U-boat, brought down in short order these three big battleships, and it caused Germany to see the U-boat as their most effective naval vessel from then on to oppose the superior British fleet, and they invested in U-boat technology and building lots of them and so on in U-boat warfare. And by 1917, it was officially proclaimed as the German naval strategy. But it, like everything that seems good, it also has a bad side to it. And what happened was that this also changed the attitude toward German naval warfare, and it played a large part in bringing in the United States into the war and changing the balance of powers, which ended up bringing on a defeat for the Central Powers. But Weddigen did not experience this part of the war because these happenings, because in early 1915 he got a new submarine and a new crew, and it was called U-29. On his first patrol, he sank four freighters, but then his boat came into the vicinity of the British Home Fleet, and their previous flagship was the HMS Dreadnought, and that took to, I don't know if it decided to, if it knew, if it saw U-29, if they knew where this Weddigen was, or if they were just out for every sub after that big loss that they had. But in any case, this the horrible and massive HMS Dreadnought took out, was hunting for this for Weddington's boat, and they saw it, and after several maneuvers that took place between the two, they managed to they were much faster than the U-boat, I guess. They managed to ram the U-29, and it actually cut it in half, and the boat was trying to I don't get this last sentence too well, but they're trying to pull all hands on board, but in the end everyone perished. All the crew of that submarine, including Weddigen, perished. And the story ends with that Goliath kept the upper hand after all. Well, this David and Goliath imagery is apt for the rest of this program tonight. Both the effort to maintain truth in history and the integrity of white homelands are a battle between little David and a massive Goliath. We might hope to win a few smaller battles, but how do we win the entire war? Well, it makes a big difference the kind of people that are sent into the battle. At least as you're doing all you can, at least you can do the best job you can do, which I don't think we're doing. So in this case, Otto Weddigen is a genuine hero and deserves praise and thanks and to be remembered always. He was certainly intelligent and resourceful and had a will to win. He was obviously a good commander. He had his ship in order and his crew was doing what they were supposed to do. But he was... I said that as long as he was a, I called him a hero, but he was also a leader, you see. And as long as the Goliaths were unaware of him, he could maneuver among them and do some great damage. But once he had done some damage, then they were looking out for him. They were looking after him with strong intention to destroy. And the more successes his U-boat might have had, the more resources the enemy would put into getting him. And in this case, it was the massive dreadnought ship. The lesson is obvious, and it's also just a fact of life. You know, it's that's the way things work, and you have to figure on that. So, but as I said, you know, this Weddington was a leader, and that's what's important for us tonight. As a leader, he was out front. As a leader, he made decisions. As a leader, he took responsibility. And as a leader, he had followers, and these followers were disciplined and well-trained. Of course, they're in the military, which is a totally different situation, and when you get in the military, you're trained and you're disciplined, and they have their own law. So, you know, if you don't do it, what's expected of you, you'll pay the price. So it's there's more motivation there, but it's a system that works to bring out the best of everyone, but the fact that there was this kind of hierarchy and on the other side too is true. So You're dealing with people who are as disciplined and trained and as motivated as yourself. So one thing that a leader doesn't do is refuse to engage the enemy or hide out, or, you know, if you keep quiet, lay low so that you're not bothered, you can do that, and Goliath, whoever he is, will leave you alone. But at the same time, no progress will be made. So that doesn't show leadership. Leadership engages the enemy. That's just the way it is. So where are our leaders today? Well, they don't want to engage too much. And we only have internet warriors, I'd say, for the most part, who mistake themselves or others mistake them for leaders. But as far as I can see, they're just on the internet. Even on the internet, they disappear at times. But it makes no difference, because they're not making a difference when they're on the internet. Now, internet can be used. Internet has to be used, of course. But it has become something that it seems to be sufficient in itself. And I've heard quite a few so-called leaders who are simply internet site owners and collecting pretty good donations too, and publishing things for people to read and providing places for people to make comments and interact and so on, and supposedly network and discuss and so on. But that's as far as it ever goes, and they say that they're satisfied with that. I've heard that. They're not going to do anything more, and nobody promises to do any more. Some admit they're not going to do anything more. Some don't. They try to act like avoid, you know, saying that, but you know that they're not. So that's where it lays right now. And I'm going to, on Saturday I had Matt Hale's mother, Evelyn Hutchinson, on my show, and talking with her and reading materials that Matt has prepared in the form of press releases and so on, and some of his lawsuits, really made a big impression on me. I admit it. It's made a big impression on me. I haven't had such a feeling for someone as possibly, you know, being a really excellent, super excellent person in the movement sense, as I've had with him. And I don't know if it's because there's just so little else, so little competition. And I don't know, I've never met him or talked to him personally, and I don't know enough. But what I do know seems very, very good. So I was going to go through some of his materials tonight and make sure you know what they are and let you have an opinion of it. You can get them, you know, if just listening to me read some things is not enough or not the best way, you can write to Evelyn Hutchison, and she will, I'm sure, send all this material to you too, just like she sent it to me, in the form of downloads that you can easily download from the email. So I'm going to do that, but I wanted to look at what makes a leader and try to answer the question of why we don't have one. I don't know that I have to answer that question, but I don't know if I will answer it, but that's what I have in mind here. And so what is leadership? I think this is important. I think we don't know. I think we just think we know. Real leadership is something that's very, very special, and I think people are more born leaders than learned leaders. I think they're more born than made. That's one of the questions and propositions that comes up often enough. You know, is a leader born or made? And of course, there's some ways which they would be made, but basically, if you're not born with it, I don't think you can make it. But you could. That's just my view, and it's not. I'm not very hard and fast on that because I. But I, that's what I would just think. I found a list of traits of leaders that this is actually a list that is the most well-known psychologists or whatever they would be who have studied leadership and are specialized in this, what they have come up with is the kind of traits that you find in people with really high leadership ability, and they've agreed, there's six of them that agree with just about everybody agrees on. And these six are, I found, they're pretty interesting and they're very good. I certainly agree with them. The first one being intelligence. And wow, I was happy to see that because I really believe in intelligence, and I don't think anybody who's not quite intelligent, way above average intelligence, can accomplish a whole lot. In a field like this, or in any field really, but intelligence is something that not just talking about a kind of good intelligence, but I think it has to be really superior intelligence. I don't think if you're too intelligent, it would be that good because you'd be. If you have an IQ, say, in 180s or something like that, I think you would be a little too far beyond the average people, and you'd probably be more likely to be an academic of some type and writing lots of books about, more arcane topics or something than you would to be a popular leader. So you want your intelligence to be high, but not super high. And I think Evelyn Hutchison said her maths, and she thought his IQ was 132. I guess it got measured at that at one time. And that's high. That's very good. And it's plenty sufficient if you have all kinds of other qualities fall in line with it. That's all the intelligence you need, really. So there's that. And then the second item is adjustment. There wasn't any definition for adjustment, but you can just understand what it is. It's not really necessary. It means, to me, you can adjust to the changing circumstances, various changing scenarios and so on, all the surprises that come along and so on. And it doesn't throw you for such a loop that you can't go on or you just can't deal with it. You have to be able to adjust, and that's a very difficult one, I think. To be a person who can, I suppose you'd say, stay calm, not that you couldn't get upset and express some anger or displeasure or whatever and still adjust to things. You know, I don't think you have to be Mr. Serenity, but you do have to continue on no matter what. You know, you adjust to the new situation, to the changes, and then you take that into consideration and you go on from there. That's very important in leadership, certainly. Then the third one is extroversion. And extroverts tend, according to the definition, tend to enjoy human interactions and to be enthusiastic, talkative, assertive, and gregarious. Well, that makes a lot of sense. It doesn't mean that you have to be, you know, super outgoing, but you have, you know, you would have to enjoy human interaction, wouldn't you, to be able to work with people. And you would have to feel enthusiastic. And you have to be able to talk if you're talkative. I'm talkative, but I don't know that I'm always an extrovert, but I'm assertive is another one, and gregarious, getting along with people, and you know, being able to get into a crowd or get into a number a place where you're going to be speaking or something, and you're good at getting along with all the people there and feeling friendly toward them and so on. That's, I should really look up gregarious to give a better definition of that. But, well, I'm not going to. So now the fourth one is conscientiousness. And that's a personality trait of being thorough, careful, or vigilant. And it's says quite a bit here about conscientiousness. It implies a desire to do a task well. Conscientious people are efficient and organized as opposed to easygoing and disorderly. They exhibit a tendency to show self-discipline, act dutifully, and aim for achievement. Very achievement-oriented. They display planned rather than spontaneous behavior. They are generally organized and dependable. People who score low on conscientiousness tend to be more laid back, less goal-oriented, and less driven by success. They also are more likely to engage in antisocial and criminal behavior. I included that because I thought that was pretty interesting. I'm an extremely conscientious person myself, but And I know the benefits of that, but it can also make you a little depending on your personality. I guess if you're not extrovertish enough or something, if you don't adjust well enough, it can make you less tolerant of those who are not. But if you don't have any conscientiousness, you're more likely to even fall into antisocial and criminal behavior. Well, conscientiousness has got to be super important for a leader because you just can't be lax and you can't, as they put it here, be too laid back or too easygoing. Just doesn't work. You certainly can't be disorderly. So now the second to the last one is openness. Openness involves six facets. or dimensions, including active imagination, sometimes called fantasy, but I wouldn't get too, I don't like that using that word very much. Of course, you can that helps you to imagine things by creating, you know, it's called fantasy when you imagine something in your mind happening that's, you know, and go through it and see how it works out and so on. But fantasy has such a bad connotation these days that I don't really like using that. But active imagination, yes. Aesthetic sensitivity, attentiveness to inner feelings, preference for variety, and intellectual curiosity. I don't know why I'm talking about myself, because I'm not promoting myself at all as a leader. I've always been very open too. Now the last one is self-efficacy. Directly relates to how long someone will stick to a workout regimen or a diet, something like that. You know, your stick-to-itiveness. High and low self-efficacy determine whether or not someone will choose to take on a challenging task or will write it off as impossible. So that's an interesting one. I like that one too. Once you undertake something, will you stick with it? That's the whole thing. You know, how many people think that they can lead something and then next thing you know they've cut out. You know, they're gone, or they don't want to do it anymore, or whatever. You know, that's and I see a lot of that in what I have come, what I can see so far about Matt Hale, that he has certainly got a lot of that, where he sticks to what he believes through thick and thin, because he believes in it. So I think Matt Hale has all of these, and in full measure too. He's very good in all of this. So his life story tells you that. Now, I might just throw in here before I go any further, because I can just imagine people saying, why are you going on about this man as a leader when he's in solitary confinement with 30 years to go yet of a prison term or something like that? You know, why not work on somebody who's available? Because he's not available. Well, we'll get into that. So there's also something called, because sometimes the people that we need are not easily available. I'll just say that. But there's also something called leadership presence, and I certainly would believe in that. I think that's got a lot, that says a lot. And what I found about it, it says, what is presence? At its root, it is wholeness. The rare but attainable inner alignment of self-identity, purpose, and feelings that eventually leads to freedom from fear. It reveals itself as the magnetic, radiating effect you have on others when you're being the authentic you, giving them your full respect and attention, speaking honestly, and letting your unique character traits flow. As leaders, we must be technically competent to gain others' respect. Excuse me. But it's our unique, genuine presence that inspires people and prompts them to trust us. In short, to want us as their leader. Well, this certainly brings to mind Adolf Hitler. To me, Adolf Hitler absolutely had leadership presence. And as a matter of fact, some of you would know the story that when he first met Dietrich Eckart, Eckart had heard about him. And after they met, Eckart said, you know, Eckart was supposedly kind of his mentor, but Eckart felt that he was the true leader, Hitler. And he said, he's the one. This is the one. He's the one that's going to lead us in our struggle here for Germany. And people recognized it in Hitler all the time. So if you have all these traits, you could have leadership presence, but I imagine you could be seen to have all these traits to a good enough degree and still not have leadership presence. I imagine that could be the case. I'll just say that as far as Matt Hale is concerned, I did read before our Saturday show, actually, that in a from a newspaper article, it might have been in that Chicago Tribune article, that when he came, when he was brought into the courtroom for the first time for his trial, and all of his followers that were that had come to be observers stood up. Now, and there was a pretty good number of them too, and I don't remember the number. And I didn't go back and look at that article, but I know it was something that I thought, well, that would have been impressive. It would have been at least like maybe 15 or something. And they all stood up when he, as soon as he entered, and some of them held out their right arm in a Roman salute. Not all of them, but some of them did. And what made them do that? You know, did he tell them they had to do that? No, obviously, they saw him as their real true leader, and they had a lot of all that respect for him, and so many still do. So that tells me a little bit that he must have some of this kind of presence. Now the other question, I think I already brought it up, but is a leader born or made? I found that most theories of the 20th century argued that great leaders were born and not made. Then the current studies, that was the 20th century, the last century, current studies have indicated that leadership is much more complex and cannot be boiled down to a few key traits of an individual. And years of observation and study have indicated that one such trait or set of traits does not make an extraordinary leader. Well, that's it. You know, I think I already pointed that out, that you can't just say you've got an accumulation of traits and now you're going to be an extraordinary leader. No, there's some kind of intangible there that they're not able to pluck out. But I think you can still say that these traits are necessary for a leader. If a leader doesn't have these traits, you're not going to be able to do it. So, okay, I took, I'm now going to go to, I don't, maybe here I'll throw this in because I might not get back to it. This is in a couple of places here. No, I'll wait until we get to this. I think that'll be better. So I've got some press releases here, and I'm going to start out by reading the whole thing, and then I'm not going to read all of it each time because it's repetitive, and you know, there's always a opening, a beginning, and a ending of these press releases that's the same. You know, it says the same thing. And these are written, I'm sure they're written by Matt Hale and sent to his mother, and his mother types them up, and maybe so there was somebody else who was typing them up and putting them out. And not that anybody, I don't know who is actually published them or printed them, you know, certainly not the newspapers. But, and I also don't know beyond that, the two websites that I linked to from Saturday, the Creativity Movement website, and the which I haven't really, I didn't actually study over that. I think it was just about the religion, and the Free Matt Hale, which I don't know where all this stuff is available, but it probably will be available somewhere, or it might be somewhere. I'll find out. Didn't do that yet. And but if not, as I think I already said, you can write to Evelyn Hutchison, email her and ask her to send this to you. But the first one I'm going to read is from July 18th, 2013. So he was not putting these things out, at least not regularly, until recently. And he started to really gear up, is the way I can see it, and try to draw attention to his situation and to show that he's working on it and to show what it all amounts to. What's interesting here for me is that what he has to say about his case. That's what's interesting. And how well he says it also, which shows what kind of a person he is, not only his intelligence, but also all these other qualities that I was just describing. So the first one is Hale Lawyer Breaks NSA Story, July 2013. Government spying, a danger. Wait a minute. Government spying, a danger to the American people, regardless of their innocence of any wrongdoing, Hale case proves. Reverend Martin Hale, Reverend Matt Hale is a former leader of the well-known and controversial World Church of the Creator, then the fastest growing, and when he was still involved with it, the fastest growing white racist organization in America. He is the foremost religious prisoner of conscience in America, serving a 40-year sentence in federal prison for supposedly soliciting a government spy to murder Chicago District Court Judge Joan Lefkoe, even though no evidence was produced at his trial that any such solicitation took place. The federal courts reviewing his case have thus far refused to release him in violation of the law, engaging in severe misconduct in a deliberate effort to cover up perhaps the most flagrant religious oppression by the federal government in America since the murder of the Branch Davidians at Waco in 1993. As Reverend Hale continues his fight for his vindication, he spoke out today regarding the NSA leak controversy, National Security Agency, that is, since similar spying by the federal government was directly involved in the phony case against him with horrible consequences to him, his family, and his church. The NSA leak story, furthermore, was broke by Glenn Greenwald of the Guardian newspaper, who represented Reverend Hale in his fight for an Illinois law license, and successfully represented him and his church when they were wrongly sued by victims of the Ben Smith racial shooting spree that occurred in Illinois and Indiana in July 1999. His church was sued by these relatives of the victims of Ben Smith, but they were unsuccessful in showing that his church was liable. From his prison cell at the infamous Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, Reverend Hale has this to say. These past weeks since the NSA leak broke, thanks to my lawyer, Glenn Greenwald, I have read and heard, and this is now, so, you know, he's using, Glenn Greenwald is still representing him. I have read and heard many Americans in the press say that people should not be worried about government spying if they are innocent and have nothing to hide. I am here to tell them from horrible personal experience that I suffer from every day that they are terribly wrong. I knew that a government stooge, Tony Evola, was taping me for years, but I didn't care since I knew that I would never commit a crime. Well, this scummy government of ours strung together years of recordings of me to successfully concoct a phony case against me all the same. It took a letter here and a letter there and came into court with a completed phony alphabet that hoodwinked the jury. So don't think for a minute that the innocence of the American people will protect them. Because if the government wants to railroad you, The NSA spy program will give it years of surveillance with which to do it. It will take years of your NSA spied upon communications, glue them together, and fabricate a phony crime out of them at will. The only solution is to end all federal spying on the American people and leave them the heck alone. Sure, they're going to do that. Let my predicament be a warning of the dangers of such spying. I thought that my innocence would protect me. I was wrong. And then for further comment from Reverend Hale or information about his case, write to him at such and such address. Or there's a phone number for his mother. Well, there's a couple things about this. One is that having a church is a very helpful legal device, I would say. It's very helpful legally because churches have a lot of freedom and rights in this country, in the United States, and they take advantage of it. And the way our laws are, you can have a church. You can create a church, and if it follows all these kind of rules that are there, you come under those privileges that churches have. And so being connected with the church of the Creator is, I think, a positive thing in this regard, that he is legally, I mean, he has to be recognized as a reverend of this church, and that it's his church. He started it. I thought he's had work. They had some disputes about what it could be called, copyright on the name of it. But that's a minor thing. And so when he always talks about his church, that he's not allowed to do this and that with his church though he's supposed to be able to. While he's imprisoned, that's a violation of his rights, and it is. And then the other thing is that here he says that the case against him was phony. He says that they strung together recordings of him to concoct this one recording. And I'm going to go into that recording. I've got it here a little further on. What was said in it, that was the whole center and crux of the criminal activity, the solicitation of murder, in this little short back and forth between Matt Hale and Tony Evola, that he says this was... He's saying here that they put this together and that it's not what he actually said. It's not the way that conversation actually went. But in other places, he has acted like he accepted it, and he's talked about the fact that why even what was said there is not criminally, does not make him criminally liable, and that there is no crime committed in any of that conversation, and he explains exactly why and bases it on all kinds of case law, and so that sort of made me wonder for a while. But I think now that what he's actually saying, when I think back to how he wrote that other stuff, which I will get to, that what he's saying is that even if that conversation was real, and which if the jury believed it and the court and the judge and everything, you know, took it as actual, if that is the case, if that even with that being the case, there's nothing criminal in it. They can't find, you know, they can't turn him into doing anything criminal against the law from that conversation. So he can say both. He can say that this particular conversation didn't really take place, not this way, and he can also say that what it amounts to is not criminal. So they cannot have convicted him legally on it, which they did, based on it, when there's nothing criminal in it. So that clears it up for me. And if you notice this later on, you can make up your own mind about that. But it makes a lot of sense. And this, at the same time, let's see if I've come to this thing that. Not yet. Okay. So now the next press release is in this year, 2014, February 6th. And it says, Hale files petition for judicial counsel review of his misconduct complaint against corrupt federal judges and seeks new appeal. Reverend Matt Hale, the former leader of the World Church of the Creator, has just filed a petition for a judicial counsel review of the dismissal of his complaint alleging misconduct against judges. What that is saying is that he filed this petition and the judicial counsel review dismissed it. They dismissed his petition. That's what he's complaining about here. He complained. Well, wait a minute. Maybe I'm jumping the gun here. Let me just say he has just filed a petition for judicial counsel review of the dismissal of his complaint. Yes, alleging misconduct against judges. That's right. Frank Easterbrook, Richard Posner, and John Tinder of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. The misconduct complaint was dismissed last month by Chief Judge Diane Wood, but was dismissed on erroneous grounds. Okay, they dismissed his complaint, but he's bringing it up again, saying it was wrongly dismissed by this judge. Reverend Hale is the, now that goes on with his fastest, you know, who he is, and he's been on television. He says he was America's most well-known advocate for that cause of the World Church of the Creator. And he calls it every time. He says he led the World Church of the Creator. Okay, I guess I'll read it after all. Reverend Hale is the foremost religious prisoner of conscience in America today. From 1996 until his arrest in 2003, all right, for 7 years, he led the World Church of the Creator, then the fastest growing pro-white and anti-Semitic organization in America. He was America's most well-known advocate for that cause, appearing numerous times on shows such as Today, Good Morning America, and others, as well as being known for his public speeches around the country. You know, he was a young man. He was 32, I think, in 2003, or maybe not until he was sentenced. I don't know. But he just got out of his 20s, and he could go on. He was on TV. He gave interviews a lot and spoke out for the white cause. And he had to have been a very good spokesman. I'm sorry, I never saw any of that at the time. I could probably find it on YouTube. I haven't had time to do that. Didn't think about it actually. Probably find some of that. But I was unaware of this whole thing, and until later, I heard about it. I think I first heard about him, I bet it was 2007. But that shows a strength that he could do that, and he did it. So he doesn't deny that his organization and what he is promoting was pro-white and anti-Semitic. And I noticed that he was using the term anti-Semitic with a dash between, but no capital letters, up until, just more recently, the last few press releases that I'm going to read, he changed to anti-Jewish. So that's just something I noticed. He was using anti-Semitic, and he's maybe now using anti-Jewish for whatever reason it might be. So he's gave public speeches around the country. It reminds us here that he's a 1998 graduate of Southern Illinois University School of Law. He was convicted in 2004 on phony charges of having solicited the murder of Chicago federal judge Joan Lefkow, even though there is no evidence that any such solicitation occurred. He has offered to take an FBI endorsed lie detector test to prove his innocence, but Assistant United Attorney David Bindi has recently refused that sensible attempt at achieving justice. Now, I think that repeating all this all the time is good because and he's able to do it without getting tired of it. I mean, he's able to be very thorough. That's that conscientiousness. He's able to be very thorough and make sure everything is said, and every time it's said, what he's saying becomes stronger. He's not saying, oh, nobody wants to hear this again. No, he continues to repeat it, and that is also, have to see that as a good tactic. Now, goes on. The misconduct complaint alleges and demonstrates that judges Easterbrook, Posner, and Tinder turned down Reverend Hale's habeas corpus appeal in March because of hatred for his religious beliefs in violation of federal law. A copy of the misconduct complaint and Reverend Hale's new petition for judicial council review is available from the office of the clerk of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. From his prison cell in solitary confinement at the infamous Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, Reverend Hale had this to say. Chief Judge Wood was quick to dismiss any misconduct complaint against her colleagues as soon as she saw it because she apparently did not realize that a complaint that alleges discrimination on the grounds of religion in deciding an appeal cannot legally be dismissed without a full review of the merits of the claim. See, did you get that? He's saying that she doesn't even know the law, and she's acting illegally there by dismissing this without a full review. This in itself is somewhat disturbing since it reveals an ignorance of the law that one would hope not to see from a member of the federal bench. In any case, a man should not be denied his rightful freedom due to the religion he practices, and this is a principle that I intend to vindicate come hell or high water. Hopefully, the judicial council will treat me with the fairness that has thus far been hideously denied to me by the judges of the Seventh Circuit Court. And then, he tells you who to contact, how to contact people, or contact information. Now, the next one is Hale sues Federal Bureau of Prisons, seeks $19 million in damages. This is on the February 13th this year. And it says, now I'm not going to go through all this first part here, but he's seeking $19 million in compensatory and punitive damages, as well as declaratory and injunctive relief for numerous and severe violations of his constitutional rights that have occurred during his false imprisonment at the infamous Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. The 30-page complaint alleges, among other things, that the wardens of Supermax and their subordinates have repeatedly imposed bans upon his correspondence with the outside world in an effort to thwart his constitutional right to participate in his church and religion. The case promises to be the most important lawsuit filed in decades because it will determine whether the federal government has the legal right to stop its prisoners from expressing whatever beliefs they may hold to the outside world. So he gives the case number and so on. And this entire 30-page complaint is available also, and I have it here, and I was going to read some of that, but it's I don't know that I will need to do so because it's pretty much summed up in this particular press release. But it is available to see it. It's all nicely organized and, you know, number this in numbers and headings, easy to follow. Until his arrest in 2003, Reverend Hale was a man. Okay, we got that. He goes through that, his being on TV and so on again, and how he was convicted of false charges, and there's no evidence for it. Okay, from his prison cell, Reverend Hale had this to say about the filing of the lawsuit. With this lawsuit, I am on the attack from now on. I seek to stop the federal government from ever again imposing bans upon my mail, as well as clear the way for the resumption of my leadership of and participation in our great church and cause. There is no legitimate reason why I should not be allowed to be just as active for our white race from within these walls as I was when I was a free man, and I intend to vindicate that right fully. Rumors of my demise as a societal force are to be reckoned with. Rumors of my demise as a societal force to be reckoned with were entirely premature. Okay, so this complaint has got a whole lot about his mail, not getting his mail. See, I've got them right here. I've got some of them. Well, I didn't get to finish. Claim two is First Amendment retaliation, the taking away of Reverend Hale's mail rights because of his engagement in constitutionally protected activity. And under that, it says, Reverend Hale repeats and realleges paragraphs 1 through 77 as if fully stated herein. Number 80, by imposing mail bans upon him because of his trying to participate in his church and religious faith, as well as his exercise of his freedom of speech, the defendants have intimidated Reverend Hale from continuing to engage in these constitutionally protected activities. By imposing mail bans on him if he tries to write about this, write to these people and so on. So that intimidates him from doing so. Then claim three is a violation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which has a number, and says the taking away of Reverend Hale's mail rights because of his involvement in his church and religious faith. Well, I thought claim 11 was pretty important. I could actually bring that up and look for that right now. See if I'm only here's claim 2. Wow. 6. Claim 9 is the violation of Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the refusal by defendant Berkebile, I don't know how you spell that, Berkebile, I think that's the warden, and BOP, that's something of prisons, the prison itself, to provide Reverend Hale with his creativity religious diet. You know, I was thinking about that. Now, this diet is seeds and raw fruits and vegetables and something else like that. Raw. And they probably say this is not, he'll die on this diet. We won't be able to keep him healthy if he eats like this. And then he'll get all ill and we'll be responsible. So this is not, I know they think to themselves that this is a bogus religion or something, but still, according to the law, I don't think they can do that. So, but they obviously don't provide him with this kind of a diet. Maybe they, for some reason, they have a way out of it. But claim 10 is violation of a First Amendment to allow Reverend Hale to be interviewed in person by Larry Yellen of Fox News Chicago. That was when he was not allowed, that person was not allowed to come into the prison to interview him. And claim 11 was violation of Eighth Amendment, the imposition of broad mail bans and religious scripture bans upon a prisoner housed in solitary confinement for indefinite duration. Yeah, that they won't allow him to have his religious literature. I guess they don't want him to read any of that, and they don't want him to read the Nature's Eternal Religion or any of those books. Maybe he doesn't have those. And if he's going to be in solitary confinement for indefinite duration, they should allow, he doesn't have his religious scripture, is what he's saying. Makes sense, right? I mean, it sounds right. And then he goes into a lot of details about that. So, close. I'm just going to close that. Okay. Now going on to 9 o'clock. All right. Going on to the April 28, 2014. This one I don't have the title on it, but it has it's about Congressman Aaron Schock, S-C-H-O-C-K. That's his congressman for Peoria. And also Washington, which is close to Peoria. And the Reverend Matt Hale, America's foremost political and former leader, let's say he's probably left off prisoner, and former leader of the pro-white and anti-Jewish, here comes the word Jewish, pro-white and anti-Jewish Church of the Creator, announced today that he has asked Representative Aaron Schock, Republican, his U.S. congressman for the district of his hometown in Illinois, to launch a congressional investigation into the criminal conduct of judges Frank Esterbrook, Richard Posner, and John Tinder of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. These judges recently falsified the facts of Hale's case for freedom on appeal in order to deny his release from prison that was required by law. Congressman Schock is presently considering Hale's request. Reverend Hale had this to say about it. The simple fact of the matter is that the misconduct committed by Esterbrook, Posner, and Tinder, in my case, these are prison authorities, I think, is clear and absolutely reprehensible. When judges outright lie about a man's case for freedom in order to deny him that freedom, not only do they egregiously wrong the man in question, but they destroy any and all credibility of the legal system itself. These are things that the Congress of the United States should rightly be concerned about. It is my hope that Representative Schock, though he is young and new to Congress, will have the guts to take on the corruption and will refer this matter to the House Judiciary Committee. Ideally, I would like to see the three judges be impeached as well as criminally prosecuted, since lying about the facts of a case on appeal in order to deny the appeal constitutes obstruction of justice in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1503. Judges shouldn't be above the law any more than anybody else. You know, I might have this more about this coming up, because this is important, wherein these are judges, Esterbrook, Richard Posner, and John Tinder. Okay, they're judges of the Seventh Circuit Court. Why am I thinking they're prison officials? When he came up with this appeal, his case was one thing, and then they said it was one of these guys, I think it was Esterbrook, said it was something else, and then judged on that. It's like a straw man. He created a different argument than what Matt was saying, had given, and then he found fault with it and said, we can't rule on such a thing, and so it was dismissed. And this was all, this is described somewhere, and I don't know, I'll have to see if it comes up. Now, on August 13th, 2014, that's just, this is September. That's just a month and a half ago, if that much. He came out with this one. Hale addresses his supporters around the world. He says to his supporters, "My brothers and sisters, I am unbeaten and unbowed as I continue to fight to return to my rightful place in the free world, and as I continue to fight for our great cause, for our people itself from within these walls. I will never capitulate, just as I expect you to never capitulate in the struggle to preserve our white race. The tables can and will be turned. We can and we will regain control over our own destiny as a people. You must never forget, though, that victory or defeat is entirely within your hands alone. For if you do your duty to win our people to our cause, victory will certainly come, whereas if you do not, it will assuredly elude us. Do not think, in other words, that saving our white race depends on somebody else, whether it be the Jews, their lackeys in government, the economy, or on any other persons or circumstances. Rather, victory depends on you and you alone. You must engage with our white masses every chance you get and persuade them from the cause of loyalty, persuade them that the cause of loyalty to our kind is right. Whether it be face to face, on the phone, through letters to the editors of newspapers, or through any other venue, the people must be actively won to our cause, because this is the only way that our victory may be obtained. On the other hand, merely being on the computer accomplishes very little, and it never will. The masses will never come to us through a computer screen. Rather, we must go to them. There is nothing about our great cause that we should be afraid to say straight to their faces, for we are the ones in the right. Never in my 43 years of life have things been so right for us to win thousands and indeed millions of our people to the cause of racial loyalty. But if we drop the ball, our race will no doubt continue on its present path towards destruction. It is not enough merely for us to believe in our cause. Rather, we must win over every white man, woman, and child as well. Right now, for example, millions of white Americans are fed up with the illegal immigrant invasion problem. These people can easily be made to see that only our racial loyalty cause can solve this and every other problem. But what is being done to win the average white man and woman who is fed up about the border situation to our side? Nothing that I know of. I know that I am in prison and cannot see everything that goes on out there, but merely far more can be done to rally our people in the public square. What I do not see is our cause on my television set, and that is always a failing on our end because it is absolutely imperative that it be on there and on a regular basis at that. Well, we had Robert Ransdale got on TV a little bit in his area for his Senate race. He had to create a Senate race and had a theme with Jews We Lose, but that's his TV pieces. His TV ads have been denied now by the television station, and he's not that dynamic, Robert. He's a real good guy. I mean, he goes out and does what nobody else does, but he's not all that dynamic either. That's the kind of thing that needs to be done on a much larger and wider basis. And Matt goes on to say, that is because of the fact that for the white masses, if a cause is not on television, it does not exist. Recall that I myself debated our foes on a regular basis on television when I was free, bringing our cause into the living rooms of thousands and millions. I have been sad these years, though no one has apparently taken my place. Victory, once again, is up to you. Do me proud and make it happen. We can have a new country of our own and save the race that we love. And then it says, in other news, he's appealed the denial of his latest case for freedom to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals and expects a decision early next year. Well, this, I think, is an important one and tells us a lot, because he can say these things because he did do it when he was free. He did go out and never failed to go out and never apologized, as far as I know, for his beliefs. He stood up for his beliefs, but he was always... I think that he wasn't crude or rude. He was always well behaved and well groomed and intelligent. That's what it takes, and there's not too many that have the guts to do such a thing. But that is what he's saying that has to be done, and he wishes that somebody had taken his place and he could be seeing some of this going on, but no, hasn't happened. All right, on May 5th, 2014, he released this. It says, Hale files new case for freedom, asks Denver judge to release him from custody. And at this point, I'm going to, I'll finish these. Attorney Reverend Matt Hale, tells us about him. And he has filed a new application for a writ of habeas corpus, as well as a brief in support of that application in federal court in Denver, Colorado. And this is just from May. And the case is Matthew Hale versus David Birkabile, warden, or Birkabile, who is the warden of the prison. It says, has a number, and Reverend Hale is representing himself. In his 28-page brief, Hale demonstrates conclusively that he is being imprisoned for conduct that is not against the law, that the court has the legal power to release him from prison, and that it should exercise that power in the interests of justice. All right. There he's putting, this may be where the part that I was talking about, but he, in this 28-page brief, he demonstrates that he is being imprisoned for conduct that is not against the law. That is that conversation with that informant, Evola. There was nothing against the law there. And the court has the legal power to release him, and it should do so, but it's not doing so. He wants it to do so. He says, Hale also exposes the severe misconduct committed by the judges who ruled on his previous bids for freedom, as well as provides new evidence of misconduct committed by the foreman of the jury, Mark Hoffman, that no court has seen previously. This is what Evelyn Hutchison was telling us about on Saturday, that the foreman of the jury said under oath, just not recently came out, that he had not followed the rules of the judge's instructions as a jury member in Hale's trial, and that he did read all about Hale, he knew all about Hale, and he had a particular fear for his own life because of the Ben Smith thing, the Ben Smith killings. So he knew all about that, too. They actually, Ben Smith killings had been allowed to be brought up in that trial, which they shouldn't have been either. But so he goes on to say, there is thus good reason to believe that Hale's new case for freedom will prove successful and that he will be able to return to his loved ones, his family, and growing mass of supporters. That's what they don't want. In the near future, after more than 11 years of wrongful imprisonment. A copy of his brief is attached to this press release. Well, I'd like to see that brief. I might have it here. Who knows? Here's the... Then he says, we must arouse the conscience of the people and maybe that of some of the judges as well as to the hideous wrongs that have been done to me by a legal system that is supposed to dispense justice. Liars should not be judges and judges should not be liars. Well, that's just a quote that I took. I'm not sure where that's from, but I guess I thought I would... save it, because he's speaking very strongly there and calling them liars. Just comes right out with it, how bad it all is, how bad what they've done is. He's not... So now this is a letter from Evelyn Hutchison to the warden, Birkebile, and she says, I'm writing to you about my son Matthew F. Hale. I want to thank you for lifting Matthew's mail ban. I don't know how long you have been the warden at Supermax, so I don't know if you realize my son is innocent. Matthew has just filed his petition to the Supreme Court. I would like you to read the following excerpt from the petition. And it's described as in this way. The sum total of evidence that Hale supposedly solicited murder and obstructed justice in the following excerpt from a conversation between Evola and Hale the next day. Okay, that this is the conversation that Evola taped and supposedly, and this is what it says. And when I read it, the first time I thought, well, why did he talk like that? You know, he said things that didn't sound very good. Hale did. It seemed a little silly. But then he explained it himself. And I must have that because I still have a ways to go here. So this is it. Evola said, well, I got your email about the Jew judge. Hale says, right. Evola, you wanting his address and the other rats, he didn't say addresses, but that's what he meant. You wanting his address and the other rats. Hale says, that information, yes, for educational purposes and for whatever reason you wish it to be. That didn't seem very smart to say, but then... Hale is going to point out that there's nothing criminal about that. So, and he also has said that this was tampered with, that he didn't actually say these things this way. So, would have to be come out in the wash, you know. But so that's the problem that it hasn't been reviewed. So, Evola says. Are we going to see what it was? The background was that Hale was concerned with this copyright case that was in the courtroom of Judge Lefko, I think. And he wanted to get that straightened out. And he wanted the addresses of some of these people, and he wanted to have his people go out and do a demonstration at their homes. You know, he wanted his creators to go out and do a demonstration at their homes. That's why he wanted the addresses. It was just about addresses. But they're trying to make it sound like he wanted it so he could go and harm these people or something. You know, he wanted their address so he could go and harm them. So Hale says, that information, yes, for educational purposes, yeah. Okay, then, but whatever you, for whatever reason you wish it to be. Then Evola says, I'm working on it. I got a way of getting it. when you get it, the information, no, that's in quotes, when you get it, we're going to exterminate the rat when we get it. So it's still about the addresses. He's working on getting the addresses. He has a way of getting the addresses. And when we get the addresses, are we going to exterminate the rat? Hale answers, well, whatever you want to do. Evola says, Jew rat. He didn't put the word Jew in there, so he's just there adding, exterminate the rat, and then he's adding, saying Jew rat. And Hale says, continues, from whatever you want to do. Basically, it's, you know, my position's always been that I'm going to fight within the law, and that information been, oh, darn it, this is all messed up here. I'm going to fight within the law, but that information's been provided. If you wish to do anything yourself, you can, you know? Evola, okay. So that makes it clear, Hale says. Evola says, consider it done. That's the end of that. No, Hale says, good. So this so-called evidence the government used to send my son to prison for 40 years. And, you know, Evelyn says that he's innocent. Well, the next thing I've got here is of the brief that I was talking about, the brief that is in support of the application for the writ of habeas corpus. And there's no date on it. It's a date from before. And it says, I don't have it all here, but I just put down the first part of it. After a jury trial in which defense counsel called no witnesses, Matthew Hale was convicted on April 26, 2004, of having solicited a government informant to murder U.S. District Court Judge Joan Lefkoe and having obstructed justice by virtue of the alleged of that alleged solicitation. On the contrary, Hale is clearly there's no evidence that any such solicitations occurred. On the contrary, Hale is clearly an innocent man who in fact turned down involvement in the government informant's own proposed and propounded murder plot. Nevertheless, regardless of his clear innocence, both factually and legally, he was sentenced to a whopping 40 years under the terrorism guideline, and his convictions and sentence were affirmed by the Seventh Circuit in 2006, and it gives some cases. And then I've got here much, much more, see March 17th brief. I guess I didn't want to write all that down. But I'll finish this, and then we'll see what might be missing. And next press release on May 13th, 2014, it's an open letter to Judge Lefkoe from Hale asserts innocence and seeks her support. Yeah, it's Hale wrote a letter to this judge, and this explains quite a few things. He says, Reverend Hale is now making this letter public, this letter that he says he mailed this. In his March 13th letter to Judge Lefkoe, March 13th, 2014, he also accuses the Jewish prosecutor, David Weissman, of deliberately having sought to concoct a phony plot against her life. He has still not received a response from Judge Lefkoe to his letter. It's now May, and from March to May, he hasn't received an answer from the judge. But, you know, now here he is, the head of a anti-Jewish church, pro-white anti-Jewish church, and he has a prosecutor who's a Jew. I don't know what the law says there, but obviously this man is going to be pretty prejudiced against him, although prosecutors usually are. out to get the person that they're prosecuting, so maybe that doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But it's interesting that he is he's definitely a Jew. And the Reverend Hale is now making this letter public and does so for several reasons. First, since he has still not received a response, he is concerned that his letter was prevented from reaching Judge Lefkoe by those who desperately seek to stop the truth from reaching her, that he is innocent of having solicited her murder, that he can prove it, and that the Jewish prosecutor needlessly put her in fear for her life for political reasons. Thus, he hopes that that his letter may indeed reach Judge Lefkoe's attention. Second, he was recently accused by prison staff of having harassed Judge Lefkoe by writing her. He wants to show plainly that his letter to her was not even remotely harassing in any way. Third, the public simply deserves to know that Reverend Hale has sought Judge Lefkoe's help, not hurt, in his struggle for his rightful freedom. The completed text of the letter follows. You may recall that on Saturday, Evelyn Hutchison said that he actually had a friendly feeling toward Judge Lefkoe, and because she had ruled in his favor originally, and then the appeal of the higher court said she had to change it. But he didn't have anything against her. But anyway, here he writes to her, "I had intended on contacting you once I had won my freedom on appeal, as I always thought I would. I presumed that if I contacted you in the meantime, your response would be, if anything, that I should simply pursue the legal process. Well, I have, and it failed to secure me justice. One look was taken at my name and the nature of the charges, and my and any and all fairness went straight out the window. So I am forced to write you now under the present circumstances that are certainly less than ideal. I hope that you may please understand. I do not mean you any ill will in any way, and I hope that lack of malice may be mutual, at least while you read this letter. I realize the awkwardness of this situation, but I assure you that it is even greater on my end than yours, for you see, I am innocent of having solicited your murder and am thus in a horrible situation that few can understand. So I beg your indulgence that I may be allowed to communicate with you free of any prejudice and hatred that would preclude the attainment of truth and justice. You have undoubtedly been fed so much false information these years that I can only hope that you can somehow set that all aside, at least for the moment. No matter how many years pass, the truth is still the truth, and the truth is that, like I say, I am innocent. So I ask you this, if I could prove to you my innocence of having solicited your murder, would you still want me to be imprisoned as an innocent man for 40 years? In other words, if I could prove to you that I never sought any harm to you, would you still want me to suffer this misery?" And you know, the thing about Joan Lefkoe, which I kept getting confused, is that she is not Jewish. She was married to a Jew, and supposedly she had three children, mixed race children. I don't know if they were his children or she had marriage before that. But and he was murdered. Her husband and her mother, if you recall, were murdered just not in the last couple of years, last year or something, or 2 years ago. And it had no connection whatsoever to Matt Hale or anybody involved with him. And that eventually, through DNA, they caught and are sure of the real murderer. And this man, once he was arrested by the police, he was stopped for a traffic offense or something, and he shot himself in his car as the police were approaching his car, the traffic police. So and he had a letter a suicide note that admitted his guilt, and then they connected him DNA-wise with some things in the house there. So he is the murderer, and it was because of his own case his own case that he had brought a malpractice suit into her court, and she dismissed his malpractice suit. And he was so upset by that he decided to go and kill somebody. And he went into their house. Maybe he didn't find her. He found her husband and mother. Her mother was 89 years old at the time, and her husband was either 68 or 70 something. So they were a little bit on the elderly side, but and she came home and found them. And she's still alive. She's still around. Nobody ever killed her. So he's saying, again, you see, I'm asking for your help. Yes, your help, because you are the only person I know of who could persuade the new AUSA assigned to my case, David Bindi. The AUSA is some kind of a person that is helps him with his appeals. To give me the lie detector test that I have always sought, a test that will prove without any doubt that I sought you no harm. The test will also prove the following facts. One, that the government informant was not even talking about you on December 5th when he queried about exterminating a, quote, Jew rat, and thus there was no solicitation of your murder in any case. Two, that I knew that the government informant was exactly that, and thus I obviously did not solicit a known government informant to murder you. Three, that I turned down the government informant solicitation on December 17, 2002, that you be murdered, and thus not only am I innocent of any solicitation, but I also refused to participate in any plot against your life when offered. Four, that the person responsible for all of this, Prosecutor David Weissman, deliberately sought to concoct a federal case he knew did not exist. So this is where we get, I guess, that explains what actually is going on here. He goes on to the judge. In the meantime, please ask yourself this question. Excuse me. If I had really solicited your murder on December 5th, 2002, why would I write you a letter on December 12th, 2002, asking you to hear a pending motion in the trademark case? You see, the facts don't fit a murder solicitation, and they never did. Even without the lie detector test, I can prove to you all of the foregoing facts without the lie detector. I only ask that you express a willingness to hear me out. Will you please do so? I will provide you with all of the evidence that you need as soon as I hear back from you. In the meantime, please contact AUSA David Bindi at, sometimes it's Bindle and sometimes it's Bindi, at this phone number and ask him to provide me with the lie detector test. A horrible wrong has been done to me these years. I ask only that I be allowed to prove that to your satisfaction, and that once I do, that perhaps garner your support for my release. Please consider this request. I hope that I may hear from you soon. I would like to return to the violin that I love. Sincerely, Matthew Hale. All right, there's more yet. I want to invite people to call if you want to call. The phone number is 323-642-1206. And you can, if you dial that, you know, it'll ring and I'll answer your call. So if you want to call, if you want to have something to say about this, or if you want to ask a question or anything. Now, I'm going to go back right now to something that I left off on when I talking about that script, that transcript of the conversation between Tony Evola and Matt Hale. And, you know, what she could, I had said, it kind of bothered me. And I thought, why did he let Tony talk like that? And why did he tolerate him? Why did, he knew he was a government informant, and he kept him around, he says, for 2 years after knowing that. And but Hale's Evelyn explained that on, oh boy, I got to go there too. Evelyn explained that on Saturday when she said that Tony Evelo was a big guy, he was intimidating, and he acted as Matt's bodyguard. And so Matt Hale must have thought that that he needed that bodyguard. Maybe he made him feel safer. And so he had a he knew what he was, but at the same time, he didn't think he was, you know, he was dangerous or he was going to hurt him. And he was just a little bit too naive. He was too naive to think that this guy would not be, if he was an informant, he must have known that he was going to be recording conversations. But at the same time, Hale said again and again that he thought as long as he didn't do anything wrong and he didn't say anything wrong and he didn't think he said anything wrong, then it's a question of whether that's a real conversation or not, but that he couldn't get in trouble, no matter if the guy was recording his conversations. And I also want to bring out, let's see, I got to get back to where I was. Boy, this is long. A lot of stuff here. Oh, I'm way down past it. Okay, I've got to go. Let me get where I was. And now I'm going to go look at something on my website that Evelyn wrote in today. And she says that... I had questioned, she writes, the answer to your question as to why Matt wanted to start to work on fighting for his freedom, is the following. Because I had brought up, well, the question of, it seems like he just started this kind of in the last year or so, really. To do all this work. But I knew he must have been doing, you know, doing things, constructive things before that. And she says he had an appeals attorney, Clifford Barnard, and he and his attorney worked on Matt's appeals from the beginning of his imprisonment. Now, I wonder if this appeals attorney is court appointed. I mean, maybe they give him one to help him work on his appeals, because I don't think he could have paid for his own attorney, but might have. I don't know. It's probably something that they give to a prisoner like him, knowing he's not going to get any of his appeals agreed to, but they, you know, let him go through the motions. And it says when they had finished all of Matt's appeals, he and this attorney, Clifford Barnard, his attorney was then off the case. At that time, Matt became pro se and began working on appeals, petitions, and lawsuits himself, and he's been fighting. So therefore, she says, he's been fighting for his freedom from the beginning. He's been involved and he's been doing this from the beginning. Okay, so now I have, I think this is the last news release, and I'll be watching for the phones. It's from September 15th, 2014. So that's just like a week ago. A week ago. Exactly. That this was put out. So we're getting real recent here. And it says, defendants in Hale prison lawsuit declined settlement offer. Excuse me. Hale vows a great victory for his cause. Oh, I got to hold on a minute. I got to narrow this down. I didn't get this one done, and it's hard. It's too hard to read. Okay. There. All right. Reverend Matt Hale, former leader of the pro-white and anti-Jewish Church of the Creator and America's most well-known political prisoner, today announced that the defendants in his civil rights lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons, that's what the FBP is, or BBO, whatever. Anyway, have declined to accept the generous settlement offer that he had made to them in July. All right? He had offered to drop his lawsuit here and now, not his entire one, but his a particular one, against these three men, asking for the $19 million. He had offered to drop this if the defendants would simply agree to refrain from violating his constitutional rights in the future and would allow him to have his violin in the prison cell in lieu of the money damages that he is entitled to. Instead, the defendants have opted for a fruitless legal battle and inevitable defeat, he says. So he said, you know, I'm this whatever you call it, this lawsuit against them are for violating his rights about mail and a lot of things, his diet and so on. And also he wants to have his violin and then he won't be suing them for money. But they didn't go along with it. So Reverend Hale filed suit in February 2014, asking for $19 million in damages. I went and said it myself, so it does include his right to deliver sermons to his church, his right to send and receive mail, and his right to be provided with his religious diet. And he's gives a case number and so on. It's been widely circulated on the internet, he says, and it's the 30-page complaint that I was telling you about. And he has this to say about the refusal of the defendants to settle the case. It's really the kind of hubris, stupidity, and downright sadism that one should expect from the federal government, actually. Here they have a no-win case, but they would rather fight it out because they figure that the taxpayers are the ones who are going to have to foot the bill anyway. Plus, I suspect that the defendants could not bear the thought of my actually enjoying myself by being able to play my beloved violin in my prison cell. So my lawsuit will go forward, and we will win a great victory for our cause in the courts. Well, he's sure that he's got the law on his side. But, you know, having the law on your side is not necessarily, does not necessarily work in our system. And that's the whole thing, is that this system. And now, thinking about the Department of Justice, we've got this black attorney general, and he must hate this guy. You know, The whole Department of Justice is totally racist against whites, so I don't know. But he knows the law, and he knows he's got the law on his side. They don't have the law on their side in preventing him from doing these, from getting the rights he's entitled to. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I say here is that most of the people that we have who are what we would call political prisoners have done something. There is a case against them, and you have to try to prove that it's trumped up or something, but this one you don't, because it definitely is. You heard that conversation that he was convicted on with Tony Evola. No, Evola, sorry. And I had something where he went through the entire, I don't know where that is now, I'm sorry to say. He went, I try to find it, and I can, I don't know if I can or not, because these are all, I don't know. Well, in any case, where he went through this whole thing and explained how everything that he said was not a criminal, you know, it didn't show any kind of a crime being carried out, and he could not possibly, if the law was followed, he couldn't possibly be convicted on what he said here, even if he did say these things. You see, like saying, you can do whatever you want. He said, if you know, I'm going to stay within the law, and you can do whatever you want. And then they added, you know, like with a question mark. Like he was saying, you know, if you know what I mean, like he's suggesting it. I don't know if he actually said that, but even if he did, he said, you know, there's nothing they can't convict him on that. Because he didn't come right out and say anything. And if the other thing is that at the end, when the guy said, consider it done, but they were still talking about addresses, but then this Evola had gone off in to try to make suggestions that he's going to exterminate someone. So then at the end he says, consider it done, and then Hale says, good. I really don't know, but I'm just going by the fact that in spite of how you can take this, it's not actually saying anything, you know? It's not actually saying that he should do anything. And he says himself that he's going to stay within the law. And, oh, I know, he made the point that in no way is he responsible for what a government informant does. And he makes the point that this man, Tony Evola, was a government informant. That was admitted. He was there to try to get Hale to say something that would, that they could use against him. And Hale didn't say it. And Hale says that he's not responsible in any way for what somebody else says they're going to do. And even if he says, even if the guy would say, I'm going to go and kill somebody, and he said, well, you do whatever you want to do. I'm not going to do that. You know, you can, if you want to do it, that's your business. That's not criminal. You're not required to stop the person, to stop somebody who says they want to go and do something. I guess if they were in the act of doing it, you're supposed to stop them. I don't know if anybody has to do that either. But, you know, there's nothing, this act, he made a very good case, I believed it. And he cites all kinds of law cases, you know, previous ones, all the time in these things. And there's no crime here. So what they did was to convince the jury that there was, and Evelyn made a good case Saturday saying all the other things that happened. I'm not going to repeat those things now. I was just trying to bring up some points that we hadn't had and that gave some information about this case. And so to me, here we have a man who is definitely innocent of the crime that he was convicted of, and they don't have another crime to convict him of, and the person that he supposedly solicited to be killed was never killed, and she's still alive, and nobody ever tried, you know, this Evola never tried to kill her. Evola was an agent who was there trying to get Matt Hale to do something criminal or to say something to a criminal, and And it's all there in black and white, and yet what he's why he's where he is because he was an effective speaker and effective exponent for these racialist views, for these pro-white and anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic views, and he was. His church was growing, and therefore they wanted to put him away for a long time. And in a way, they don't want him to communicate with the outside world if they can help it. Of course, he has legal rights to do so, but they stop it, and they're doing their best to keep it from happening. So this is what's going on here, and I think that all of the qualities that this man has shown, just think, we know about our people who've been unjustly imprisoned for, say, Holocaust revisionism and so on, for like up to 5 years. It's terrible. But now he's been in this situation already for 11 years, and he's got a bunch more, I don't know what they say. Well, he's got a 40-year sentence, so and there's no indication that he's ever going to be allowed to be out of solitary confinement or in his all alone there. And I think there should, since he is now coming out with a lot of activity and efforts, I think there should be a real movement to where a lot of people who normally have not been paying any attention to this should get involved in this Free Matt Hale movement. I don't know there must be some creativity people who are leading this, and they should lead it. I'm not going to lead it, but I would talk it up, and I think there should be a lot of activity to go along with the efforts that he's making. Because he should be freed. He absolutely, two things. There's a great leader there that we don't have the benefit of. And the other thing is that it really is a terrible injustice. And when you look at the whole thing, it makes you feel, you know, your sympathy goes out. I have a tremendous amount. I feel a lot of sympathy for him because his situation really is unendurable. And yet, you know what? He has endured it so well. This shows the strength of this person. I just think that he has tremendous leadership qualities. Now, he might, if he by any chance, I don't want to be negative about it. You know, I can be, say, oh, well, they're never going to let him, but they might have to. If enough noise was made, you know, there's not enough noise. He's trying to do it through the law, but there's no public outcry. When Jews are put away, there's always huge public outcry, and it never ends. But we don't do that. And we should be ashamed to be so self-centered and lazy. I invite people who are wanting to help Matt Hale to contact me. I'm willing to be contacted and see what can be done, because I think this is something that absolutely should not be allowed to just be brushed under the rug and we all ignore it. I see a vast difference between. Maybe there isn't, but I do see a big difference between Matt Hale and Edgar Steele. Edgar Steele had changed quite a bit in the last years when he was mainly trying to sell gold. I think he had gotten very interested in making money, and that may have played a role. I don't see him being absolutely innocent in my eyes the way I see Matt Hale being absolutely innocent, and also showing such a character in all this time that he's, from the time he was arrested you know, and he's never been out of isolation since, except when he went into the courtroom for his trial. And nobody ever sees him. His mother's only visited him once in all this time. And nobody's allowed in there. It's such a rigmarole, probably hassle, to try to go and visit him. And you don't see anything. He comes into this room and you see him talk to him through glass. You don't really see what he's going through. It must be so depressing day after day all these years. It just shows the kind of character this person has, and he deserves a whole lot better from us than we've given him. If you just think of him as a racial brother, that's all. A white man who has stood up for the white race since he was a young boy. And this is the kind of treatment that he gets. So I'll just say that I would like for people who have some ideas about this and are close to it and have the energy to do something to go ahead and contact me, please. Carolyn at carolynyeager.net is my email address. And I will do what I can, you know. But I'm not going to become chairman of some campaign. At least I don't think. No, I don't. I can't do it. And this is a problem that everybody says, but I really can't. But hopefully, something will start happening. And if it doesn't, I'll talk about it some more. I'll try to get on somewhere else and talk about it. So, other than my own show. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening to this tonight. And I do hope that I have listeners for this show, even though it might have, some people may have decided to turn me off. But I'm glad I got all that stated. I wanted to say it, and I feel better for doing so. And I invite you to tune in again next week. And I will be on Saturday because it's the three-year anniversary of my website, carolynyeager.net, which falls on September 27th, Saturday. And I will be wanting to talk about that a little bit. So I will say good night for now. It's this Carolyn Yeager at bringing you the Heretics Hour tonight on September 22nd, 2014. And signing out for now.